morning, my brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus our Lord. This morning we turn our attention to Exodus chapter 2. So I'd like you all, please, everyone, to look now at the beginning of Exodus chapter 2. And you know from yesterday that as we concluded chapter 1, Pharaoh had come up with this edict, this commandment, saying that every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. That is the backdrop now for this beginning of this second chapter of Exodus, the edict of Pharaoh. And when you read through the narrative, you wonder what's going to happen now after this edict from the Pharaoh king, the divine king as he was known in Egypt. Then suddenly the sudden change of scene, and we come into verse 1. Now a man, unnamed, from the house of Levi, went and took to wife a daughter of Levi, unnamed, which is very typical, as I tried to mention yesterday, that there's a timelessness about the narrative. The specifics sometimes are just not there. We know later, of course, that the father of Moses was Amram and the mother was Jochebed. But here it's unnamed. This is timeless record. This is a record for the ages. From the sixth chapter of Exodus, verse 20, there's no need to turn to it. We know that Amram was the married Jochebed, his aunt, his paternal aunt, because Amram was the grandson of Levi, whereas Jochebed was the daughter of Levi. So there's a generational difference there. But it's not mentioned here. The emphasis is on the record. It's on the narrative. And the woman conceived and bore a son, still unnamed. And when she saw that he was a goodly child, she'd hid him 3 months. And at once, brothers and sisters, here is evocative language. What does this remind us of? The woman conceived and bore a son, and she saw that he was good. She saw that it was good. This is exactly the language of Genesis chapter 1. God's creation, he saw it, and he saw that it was good. This is the language of spiritual creation. Now, this is the wonderful counterpoise between the beginning of Exodus and the beginning of Genesis. The language in so many respects is similar. In Genesis, we have the physical creation. Here in the Exodus, we have the Genesis of God's people, the people of Israel. And so she saw that this child was a goodly child. And she hid him 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds at the river's brink. Now, there are two remarkable words there, brethren. This is absolutely essential for us to catch. What are those two remarkable words there? The first is, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes, a wicker basket. And there's only another place in the Hebrew scriptures where that word basket is used. And do you know where that is? It's in the book of Genesis, when Noah was placed in an ark or a basket and floated seemingly without purpose on the waters of the great deep. And so there's a direct counterpoise here between the basket of bulrushes and the situation in which Noah was placed. Here is a child of promise in a sort of an aimless situation. There's no rudder, there's no power in this ark. There's no rudder, there's no power in the ark of Noah. It's all there, dependent upon God's mercy and God's goodness. It's just, it's a child adrift. There's no power there. The basket has no power, has no means of generation or direction. It's just there, like Noah's ark, waiting for God's providence to work. And so there's this magnificent counterpoise again between the basket and the ark in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 14. And what is the second remarkable word here? She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds at the river's brink. The sea of reeds. This becomes extremely important for us later in the Exodus account. This is the beginning of the concept of the Red Sea. It's the Sea of Reeds. And so she put the child in the basket and placed it among the reeds at the river's bank. And there, brethren and sisters, if you can just pause for a moment, you think that God's purpose is hanging on a thread exceedingly slim. Exceedingly slim. The whole purpose of God is hanging on a child in a basket, in the drifting in the waters of the Nile. And you immediately think, what is the counterpart in other scripture? Isn't this a counterpart of the babe who lay in a manger? An impossible situation. Here is this babe, here is God's purpose is embodied in Moses, this three-month-old child drifting in the waters. And on the other side, you have the absolutely invulnerable Pharaoh, the impregnable Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, the one who was the supreme power, the one who was the pagan divinity. This child, this tiny, tiny child, this three-month-old child, adrift without power, without direction, without steerage, in this ark. But this child, brothers and sisters, would be absolutely triumphant against all the powers of Egypt, against all the powers of Pharaoh, even, brothers and sisters, as Jesus Christ himself, the babe in the manger, this babe in a manger amongst the cattle there in Bethlehem, he would be the salvation of mankind. The way the Lord works is magnificent, it seems to me. This idea of my strength is made perfect in weakness. My situation might be absolutely impossible. How could it be rationally conceived that salvation would come through such an unpromising beginning as this? But we know that this is what happened. We know that salvation was affected with these most unpropitious beginnings, as all God's work, brothers and sisters, as we're told so clearly by the Apostle Paul in the first letter to the Corinthians, that my strength is made perfect in weakness. So his sister, this is very much biblical narrative, what happens next. His sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. This is Miriam coming into the picture. And remember that Miriam later leads the great song in Exodus chapter 15. So she's here at the beginning as she was in the end of this great deliverance. His sister stood at a distance to know what would be done. Just like we do when we read the narrative. What's going to happen? What would be done? Verse 5, now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. This is exactly the language of what Pharaoh would do later when he would come down bathing at the river before some of the plagues were announced to him. It's all highly interactive narrative. Everything sort of looks forward to later chapters in Exodus or looks back to the Genesis account. It's magnificently written. There's a divine record here without any shadow of a doubt. There's the intricacies of language. Everything seems to have an allusion to something else. I just ran out of doing lists of allusions. Everything seems to be related to something else. And so when the daughter of Pharaoh comes down to bathe at the river, it's parallel to the idea of Pharaoh himself washing or bathing at the river when some of the plagues were to be announced to him later by Moses. And so the daughter of Pharaoh comes down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walk beside the river. And she saw the basket, this tiny basket, amongst the reeds. And she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she opened it, she saw the child. And lo, the babe was crying. The only reference in the whole of Scripture, mothers will be pleased to know, I'm sure, the only reference in the whole of Scripture to a baby crying. And so she took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew's children." Now, we have to read all this at two levels, brethren. This is absolutely essential to read this at two levels. This is biblical narrative, basically, but what is underpinning it all? This is the same language as what God is going to do to Egypt. God comes down. Just what Pharaoh's daughter is doing is parallel to what God himself will do. God comes down. God sees. And God hears. It's a marvelous parallel. It's written this way, I'm sure, to ready us for the great revelation of God. God, despite all these very unpropitious circumstances, just like Pharaoh's daughter in a certain sense, he comes down. He sees. And he hears. And there's a marvelous exhortation in that. In our own personal experience, who cannot in this room identify with this, that God comes down He sees and he hears us in our own situation. And so she, like God, in verse 6, took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children. These are the words of God." It's written as though it's the words of Pharaoh's daughter, as indeed it is, but it's the word of God. "I've looked down, I've seen, and this, Moses," says God from heaven above, "this is one of the Hebrew children. This will be the one whom I will use for my purpose." So you only go on to verse 7, it's very much in a narrative style. You sort of go from sequence to sequence, wondering what will happen next. So his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, it's Miriam, of course, says to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" There's so much irony in all this. Here is the sister of Moses, here's Miriam, coming and asking, "Shall I go and find a Hebrew woman who can help bring up this child?" And Pharaoh said to her, "Go." In other words, she's saying, "I can't do it myself." This is so implicit in the language. She's saying, I can't bring up this child myself. This is like an acknowledgement. Only God's people can bring up this great Moses. Go and find somebody. And so she goes, of course, and finds the child's mother, we're told there at the end of verse 8. And Pharaoh's daughter says, "Take the child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." And here's an extreme paradox, that Moses was brought up in the house of Pharaoh, but still brought up really under the direction of his own mother, Jochebed. So the woman took the child and nursed him. This is like thwarting between the lines of the narrative. You can see that that Pharaoh's plans are being thwarted. That this child, yes, will be brought up in Pharaoh's court as a prince, but he will be brought up and trained by his mother, who came from the house of Levi. God is working. God is intervening here in the human condition. So the woman took the child and nursed him, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. He became a prince. And she named him Moses, for she said, "Because I drew him out of water." Now, there's several remarkable things about verse 10, quite remarkable things about verse 10, which I'd like to very quickly cover. First of all, what does the word Moses mean? And what is amazing about the name Moses is it has an appropriateness whether you look at it in the terms of the Egyptian language or whether you look at it in terms of the Hebrew language. Because I think we've all know that Tutmos means the king, the son of Tut. Mos added after a name means the son of. And so, very technically, Mos or Moshe means son of, or to beget a child. That's what it means. In the Egyptian, it's a very appropriate name in terms of what it means in that context. Moses means a child or a son brought up here by Pharaoh's daughter. But it has, as the commentators say, it has this assonance. That means it has a similar sounding word, Moshe, in the Hebrew language, means to draw out. And it says there, and this is the meaning which is captured in the text here at the end of verse 10, "Because I drew him out of water." It's a similar sounding word in Hebrew to the word Moses. So, to put it in a nutshell, the name Moses has an appropriateness whether you look at it in the Egyptian context or whether you look at it in the Hebrew context. In the Egyptian context, it means a son of. Yes, he was brought up as a son in Pharaoh's court. But much more specifically, it means that he was drawn out. Moses was drawn out of water. So there's a remarkable feature about the name Moses and what it means, because it has an appropriateness whether you look at it through the prism of the Egyptian context or whether you look at it through the prism of the Hebrew context. Both ways of understanding his name capture the essence of his being, the essence of his circumstance. But there's more than that. And as we read this, brothers and sisters, I hope you can catch these points before I even make them. because they should shout out at us as they come along. Before I even make these points, I hope we are alert to, as we read this text, to see that everything's interrelated. Isn't the explanation given at their verse 10 a remarkable parody of what we're told in the end of chapter 1? This is Pharaoh's edict: you shall cast the sons into the Nile. Whereas Moses' meaning, the meaning of his name is, I will draw him out of the Nile. Here is the inverse. Chapter 2, verse 10 is a clear inverse of the edict of Pharaoh in chapter 1, verse 22. Pharaoh has said, we'll throw them into the Nile. God's promise was that Moses would be drawn out of the Nile. The irony or the paradox, whichever way you want to put it, God is sort of working through all this to show in all sorts of different ways that Pharaoh's plans would be thwarted. Even when it came down to the name of Moses, it was implicitly a thwarting of God's purpose. He would draw out. He would not be cast in to the Nile. And so there's a long lapse of time now when we go into the next paragraph, which is from verse 11 through to verse 22. And we're told in Stephen's great speech, of course, in the seventh chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, that Moses was 40 years of age when you come to verse 11. So there's a whole 40-year gap from the paragraph that ends in verse 10 to the paragraph that begins in verse 11. One day, but that's after 40 years. Moses is 40 years of age now. It says there quite in a very general terms, it says when Moses had grown up, when he in fact was 40 years, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And what happened? This is very significant again, what happened to Moses when he was 40 years of age. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. Three things happened, actually, and I have them listed here on the screen. First, he saw the Egyptian beating a Hebrew. Next step, we see in a couple of verses later, we see that two Israelis or two Hebrews were quarreling. And then later in the paragraph, we see Moses encountering a situation where he was with these local Midianite shepherds. In the first case, he clearly was identifying with the Hebrew, because he looked here and there, it says, and then he, seeing no one was around, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Secondly, we're told that there was a situation which came when the two Hebrews were struggling together, and Moses intervenes. And one of the Hebrews answers, who made you a prince and a judge for us? This is exactly the same language as what the children of Israel would later say against Moses. Who made you a leader? You and Moses and Aaron, who made you a leader? So here is the sort of instinctive distrust of Moses, whether it's because of his Egyptian background, his sort of aristocratic heritage, whatever it is. But here is this sort of antagonism, in a sense, which was again prescient of what would happen later. Who would make you a prince and a judge over us? And so Moses was afraid, and he fled to Egypt. He fled out of Egypt, and he fled to Sinai. All this is what happened later to Israel. Moses, like Israel later, was subject to persecution, and he had to flee. What was happening now here to Moses was exactly what would happen later to the children of Israel. But there's a more important lesson, I think, brothers and sisters, in these three incidents, which I've just touched on very briefly here. What is the lesson that comes from this? Moses has been taught that if he takes, and this is a lesson very, very much for us in terms of exhortation, if you take the initiative without asking for God's intervention, then it will fail. That's what's happening here. Moses intervened three times. But each time, in a sense, it was counterproductive. Moses had to learn, as we have to learn, that if you take initiative, if you intervene without recognition of God's ways here, and this seems to be the way in which the account is written, then That's not the way to go. So Moses had something to learn. He had to learn, you wait and you hear what God has to tell you. You wait and hear the instructions that come from the Lord himself. Then you can be an effective leader. This is a very, very powerful point, brethren and sisters, and I'm sure I'm not contriving the narrative here. I'm sure it's written this way. These three incidents that are happening here, they were unsuccessful, unsuccessful, unsuccessful. Why were they unsuccessful? In fact, they were counterproductive in a way because he had to flee. He had problems with Pharaoh's court. He had to flee from Egypt. He had to go into the desert. He had to go into Horeb. Why were they unproductive? There's no other way to interpret it, it seems to me, because Moses had not yet heard the voice of God. Moses listened to this lesson, like we must listen to this lesson. If you take an intervention, if you take a position, if you try and do something, no matter how well-intentioned it might be, in the end it will not be successful until I intervene. I, Yahweh, in the heaven above, I am the one who leads my people out of bondage. This is the lesson of the brothers and sisters. Moses, out of his own strength, out of his own initiative, out of his own capacities, his own powers, could do his best, but it would be inadequate. God would be the redeemer of his people. But having said that, these particular incidents here certainly tell us something about Moses' character. There's sort of like a flavor you get of Moses' character that comes through all this. You have this sense of, this impassioned sense of justice. This comes clearly through this short paragraph. This impassioned sense of justice. He thought that the Hebrews had been wronged. His easily ignited temper, rather volcanic nature, it comes through into this. His selfless compassion. You can see the beginnings of this character development at this stage. And on top of all that, and this is my key point, his feelings of personal inadequacy. He had to flee. He knew that his attempts to help his people had to be aborted because they were not successful at all. And so at the end of verse 14 and 15, we read, "Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known. He'd fallen foul of Pharaoh. And so Pharaoh heard of it and he sought to kill Moses." This is another evocation, another flavor, which we'll come to in the fourth chapter of Exodus, because there, strikingly, it seems that God wanted to kill Moses. That's a very extraordinary situation, which we'll discuss in a later class. But it seems to have a counterpoint to that. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. So Moses' situation was worse than before. Now Moses fled, we're told, as we go on there in verse 15, Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, which is far away, of course, from Egypt, getting towards the Sinai. And he sat down by a well, and the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come to so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." So Moses had all the aura of a prince, of an Egyptian prince. When people met him, like these daughters of Midian, they saw him as an Egyptian. The transition to the great leader of Israel had not yet happened until the revelation of God in Exodus chapter 3. He was somehow still perceived as an Egyptian. An Egyptian has delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds. This, I think, cements the idea or compounds the idea that Moses is not ready for salvation. He's not truly identified with his people until the great commission that comes to him from God above in Exodus chapter 3. Somehow he's still identified with Egypt. He's still not prepared for his great task until Yahweh, the God of heaven, intervenes. And so in verse 20, he said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. And she bore a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." And what's the structure of the narrative? What do we see about this? We see that that paragraph ending verse 22 also ends with a naming of a son. Verse 10 ended with the naming of a son, the name of Moses. So at the end of verse 10, you have the naming of Moses, and then at the end of verse 22, you have the naming of his own son, Gershom, the firstborn. And the concept of the firstborn, brothers and sisters, is extremely important in the book of Exodus. Here is Gershom, and whose name means, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. This, you see, is the beginning of Moses' realization of what's happening here. I have been a sojourner. He's beginning to understand that he is a transient in Egypt. In a way, his mind is getting ready for the revelation of the Lord in Exodus chapter 3. And that's exactly what the name Gershom means. It means a sojourner. You come then to the final paragraph, which is a very, very important paragraph, really, in terms of sort of a summary of what's happening here. If you look at verse 23 through to the end of the chapter, that very short section, which is so very important in meaning. In the course of those many days, the king of Egypt died. We're not told who the king of Egypt is. We don't know who the Pharaoh was. Remembering, and I didn't make this point yesterday, remember that the name Pharaoh means the great house. The Pharaoh means great house. And this again is a sort of a parody. The great house would really be the house of Israel. This is the house, the people of Israel, the community of the living God. That is the great house. But the Pharaoh, the supposed great house, had died. All this is full of rich meaning. The king of Egypt, the Pharaoh who'd given so much difficulty to in the earlier parts of this narrative here, he died. That section, that dynasty was over. And we're told that the people of Israel groaned under their bondage. They cried out for help. And their cry under bondage came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew their condition. What more magnificent statement, brethren, this is good to be made of the gospel. This is the gospel in a nutshell, as you find it a number of times in the book of Exodus, which we'll certainly point out. It's just these little encapsulated paragraphs which sort of summarize it all. It's marvelous, and this is, the timelessness of the narrative. It's lifting out of this narrative, this Exodus narrative, and it's making a statement which is for all time and which bears upon every single brother and sister here in this room this morning as we meet, brother and sisters. Every single phrase, every single nuance in this section is extremely important in terms of God's plan of salvation. The people of Israel groaned under their bondage. Like the Apostle Paul says, we groan under the bondage of corruption in Romans chapter 8. They cried out for help. Don't we? Isn't this, can't we identify with the narrative? It's written that way. We cry out for help. And their cry under bondage came up to God. God is overlooking all this. He's sensitive to the situation. He's like Pharaoh's daughter. He's looking down. He sees their condition. And he hears. Their cry under their bondage came up to God. He hears all our groanings, all our sufferings, brethren and sisters, in all their different forms in which they come to us. He knows. He's the ever-present God. This is the beauty of this final paragraph in Exodus chapter 2. It's something which we can appropriate so easily for ourselves. It's clearly written for our own edification and our own encouragement. This is the God of the ages. This is the God who spoke to Moses. It's the same God who's speaking to us. And God heard their groaning. Brothers and sisters, all of us in our difficulties, all of us in our groanings, the greatest assurance, I think, in all our sufferings is without doubt knowing that God hears. There's no question in my mind, brothers and sisters, no matter how grievous the situation might be, the greatest consolation of all is to know that God hears, God knows my situation, and God remembers. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. Isn't that a marvelous reassurance? We're not forgotten. We are not forgotten in our anguish and in our groaning. We are not forgotten. He remembers his covenant. God is the eternal, faithful one to his covenant. He will not abandon us, brethren and sisters, never. He will not. We are the ones who abandon him, not he us. That's certainly clear. And so in verse 25, God saw the people of Israel, and God knew their condition. It's reworking the same language as Pharaoh's daughter. It's sort of, it's like a magnificent little piece of poetry, if you like, where all these little words are coming together, phrases like a beautiful symphony, just bringing these concepts, these ideas to the fore, letting them submerge a bit for a few verses, bringing them up again, but all weaving it into a magnificent narrative of God's ways of salvation. Therefore, the chapter concludes, God saw the people of Israel, and God knew their condition. Now, isn't that an assurance for us? I would have thought so. Isn't it an assurance for me? Certainly it is, that God knows. He knows our condition. Now, as we pause at the end of chapter 2, brethren and sisters, we know that many of these themes are taken up in the New Testament scriptures. It's not possible for me to go through all the New Testament references to this. The first one is obvious as we sort of look just for a few moments, glance back at the earlier part of chapter 2. We know that this is an allusion to the Lord Jesus. We know it's God's purpose is hanging on that thin thread, like Moses in the ark and the bulrushes. We know that's what we read yesterday in our readings, in our groups, in Matthew chapter 2. It's clearly the same sort of situation. But it's explicitly taken up, for example, in Stephen's speech in Acts chapter 7. There's no question that it's specifically referred to, this incident in Acts chapter 7, where Stephen, in his speech, says that here is an instance of the people rejecting me. You remember how Acts chapter 7, the second part of Stephen, or the second section of Stephen's speech, he uses this Exodus chapter 2 to show that God was not, that the children of Israel did not accept, at least not immediately so, the salvation that was offered to them. But more specifically, and I'm sure you all remember this, brothers and sisters, the language of Hebrews chapter 11, and it would be quite remiss not to turn very, very quickly to Hebrews chapter 11, which is a direct commentary on Exodus chapter 2. Just look very, very quickly, if you would, at Hebrews chapter 11. You know this passage well, but it has a richness, I think, which is assisted by having looked somewhat at Exodus chapter 2. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid for 3 months by his parents. This is a supreme example of faith, we're told here, because they saw that the child was beautiful, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. This is, we're not told that in Exodus chapter 2, but it's clearly there, sort of underneath the record, that the Pharaoh's mother was not afraid of the king's edict. This is faith. We're not daunted by the things of this world. We are not. We are not afraid of the king's edict. And so, by faith, Moses, we're told there in verse 24 of Hebrews chapter 11, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. This is a marvelous text, brothers and sisters, because this is implied to us when we read Exodus chapter 2, because we know that if Moses had decided to stay in the princely court, we know that he would have perhaps risen to positions of great power. It's an extraordinary act of faith on Moses' part, even though his faith was incomplete, as we've shown there in the second chapter of Exodus. He still recognized that the pleasures of Egypt were fleeting, absolutely fleeting, and it was better, far better, to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. But then look very particularly at verse 26 of Hebrews chapter 11, a very, very important passage to bring it into our context. He, that is Moses, considered abuse suffered for Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. So somehow Moses had some concept of salvation. It was very imperfect, it was very blurred, as we've noticed, but there was some feeling within him, the way his circumstances of growth had happened and so on. He must have known that there was something extraordinary about his circumstances, something really extraordinary, even though it was all opaque and sort of out of focus. He must have known when he heard from his mother, when he heard about the situation in which he'd been rescued from the river Nile and so on, even though the whole thing, like us, our faith is sort of blurred, our vision is darkened, we don't understand, just like these lights are going in and out. Same sort of idea. It's blurred, we don't know. But there was something about all these circumstances which Moses must have detected in these 40 years of development as he grew. I know I'm being guided by a greater power than Pharaoh. And in the Hebrews chapter 11, it's put, he considered abuse suffered for Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. A marvelous concept of the sort of emergence of his understanding of the messianic role which we worked through him. Now I want you to turn back now, if you would, to the third chapter of Exodus. We're going to move ahead a little bit because we've got so much ground to cover that we'll touch a little bit on some issues which we'll develop further tomorrow. And I'd like you to note, just as we close that second chapter, the points which I have here on the screen. God hears Israel's sighs, four expressions of Israel's suffering: groaning, crying out, crying for help, and moaning. And the contrast, the four contrasts: God hears, God remembers, God looks upon, and God takes notice. There's a four-point contrast here. God meets all of these anxieties one for one. This is the way it's written. Every aspect of their concerns is met by a counterpart concern by God in heaven. Now we're going to just look in our closing 10 minutes, brothers and sisters, into Exodus chapter 3 to see what happens next. This is a particularly significant chapter, I would like to stress. We need to be on high alert when we read Exodus chapter 3. It's full of very, very significant issues. Now, the same Hebrew conjunction we saw at Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1, now. In other words, what happens next? God has heard their condition. What is God going to do? Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, and by then, he'd married Zipporah, the daughter of Midian, the priest of Midian, and he was looking after the flock of his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now this is extraordinary. Here is Moses, just by Sinai. Here is Moses looking after the flock. It's full of meaning. Because later he would look after the flock of Israel. Here is Moses leading his flock. Isn't it? You just think of the contrast. The prince of Egypt, the person who could well have been a pharaoh or one of the pharaohs of Egypt, here he is in the desert, in this faraway, nondescript place in Sinai, or Horeb, as it's used, as it's mentioned here. Horeb being the range, very likely, and Sinai, the mountain itself. Here he is in this dust bowl, full of rocks, away from anywhere. What a change in Moses' circumstances. For all the plushness of the Egyptian court, and when you read about the Egyptian court in the various works of scholarship, it's extremely luxurious. The prince Moses could have had everything. And here he is wandering around looking after sheep in a dust bowl, rocks, dust bowl, in Sinai, in the Sinai area, in the wilderness. Don't you think Moses must have wondered, whatever is God doing here? If I accept, as I surely do, that God is directing me, that's clear from the Hebrews 11 account, how can God possibly be working in this dust bowl with me? And how the dryness and the barrenness of all this is a clear contrast with the lushness of the river Nile. I think that's the way we're supposed to read the beginning of Exodus chapter 3. It's an extraordinary contrast with the luxuriance of the Nile Delta, the fertility of the Nile Delta, all that. And here he is in the west side of a wilderness. It's written specifically that way to make a stark contrast to the changed circumstances of Moses. And he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. This is very important in terms of subsequent Exodus history, rather than this is the Sinai. This is the place where the great law was given. This is where God revealed himself subsequently to Moses. But here he is brought initially, not knowing anything about this place, full of questions. Why am I here? And he came to this Horeb, this mountain of God. This is what matters, brothers and sisters. This is what really matters. It's the mountain. It's not just a mountain, but it's the mountain of God. And if it's the mountain of God, it must be exceedingly sacred. It must be. And Moses is not left guessing for long, brothers and sisters, why he is there. An angel of Yahweh, the first reference to Yahweh in the Exodus account, the angel of Yahweh appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And the bush is a play, is a Hebrew play on words, because the word bush in Hebrew is Sinai. It sounds very much like Sinai. It's very similar, it's Sinai. In Hebrew, midst of a bush just sounds like midst of Sinai, Sinai. And he looked, and lo, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see. God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, and he said, here am I. Then he said, do not come near. Put off your shoes from off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Brothers and sisters, the first point, the obvious point to make here is that no matter how desolate the place is, no matter how barren and no matter how far away, the place is immediately sacred when the Lord is there. It doesn't matter how unpromising it is, once the Lord is there, it instantly becomes holy. It instantly becomes sacred. And God says, do not come near, put off your shoes from off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. This is, we're so used to this passage, but it's quite extraordinary to think that being in this terrible place, I've been to Mount Sinai myself, it's just terrible in terms of desolation and darkness and hot and no water. It's just awful. It just seems like a moonscape, really, walking around the Sinai area. But this is a holy place. And as I said, it's holy, brothers and sisters, because God is there. And this, in my view, if I can use this kind of comparison, this Bible school is a holy place. It's because God is here. And that's all that matters. Doesn't matter whether Pharaoh is here. Doesn't matter whether all the riches of Egypt are here or not. It has no relevance. It's only holy if God comes and is evidently there. And so he's instructed, and we'll come back tomorrow to some of the earlier part of this, this chapter, but God instructs Moses to, as we read there in verse 5, put off your shoes from off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Now, I never really quite understood this until I went to Bangladesh. I think it helped me understand what this sort of thing means. Because in Bangladesh, whenever you go into a home, whenever you go into a holy place, you always take off the shoes from off your feet. It's just the thing to do. And you ask, why do you take off the shoes from off your feet? And the answer I was given there, and it sort of seems obvious to me now, I don't know whether you accept it, but it seems quite clear to me now, you don't have to wear shoes in a holy place because there's nothing from which you need protection. If it's holy, if it's divine, why do you need to be protected from dust and dirt? You want to touch this holiness, not to be kept separate from it. That's the idea, the basic idea, it seems to me, of taking off the shoes from off your feet. is because there's no contamination in this ground, nothing. It's absolutely holy. You need no protection. In fact, conversely, you need to get to as close to it as you possibly can. You want to touch things unseen. You want to touch this holiness. I don't read that. I don't consider these ideas, brethren, as extravagant at all. This, I think, is the idea. It's certainly a mark of respect to take off shoes from off your feet, but I think it's more than that. I think it has a spiritual overtone. And so God calls to him out of the bush, saying, "Moses, Moses," and he says, as a foretaste of the Yahweh name, and we'll come to this tomorrow, as a foretaste, unknowingly as a foretaste of the Yahweh name, "Moses, Moses," he said. Moses responds, "Here I am." Isn't that an evocation of the memorial name of God? "And know that I am Lord," the great theme of the book of Exodus. "I am the Lord that healeth thee. In thee, O Lord, I put my trust," in three verses, played by our sister Chani Brunel.
Next class will start promptly at 9:55. Please be in your seats at that time.